The headlines: President Ibrahim Raisi denounces attempts by Iran's enemies to blacklist the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, saying such moves are rooted in the IRGC's fight against terrorism. Muslim countries strongly condemn the burning of a copy of the Holy Quran by a Swedish-Danish right-wing extremist in Stockholm. And Burkina Faso calls for the immediate withdrawal of French troops from the African country amid public anger at the French military presence. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Top Iranian officials have slammed the European Parliament for blacklisting the country's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. President Ibrahim Raisi says such moves are rooted in the IRGC's role against terrorists in the region. Raisi says enemies are trying to subject a large part of the ruling system in Iran to criticism due to its success, but it will fail. He was referring to a Thursday resolution which the European lawmakers call for the designation of the IRGC as a terror group. This comes as EU foreign ministers are set to discuss tightening sanctions on Iran next week. Iran's parliament speaker is now warning of immediate reciprocal steps if the EU sanctions or the IRGC are blacklisted. Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf says Iran is ready to reciprocate against European armed forces. Earlier, political analyst Fuad Izadi joined us with his take on the rising of Islamophobia in Europe.
You know, normal people, when they fail at a project or a policy, they generally go back and try to make corrections, learn from the past mistakes, and have an action or a policy that is more reasonable. That's what normal people do. Normal countries do that. And then you have some people occasionally that when they fail, they start swearing. They start chanting, stuff that is not appropriate. And the second category of people are generally they get upset because of the failure and they start saying nonsense. And it seems Europeans are in the second category, at least the people who voted for this motion are, instead of learning from past mistakes, instead of realizing that they cannot overthrow the Iranian government, they start name-calling, they start engaging in activities that are against international law, and they're going to hurt themselves. You know, they got into a fight with the Russian government, and they are not able to use Russian energy resources. If they want to repeat that with the Iranian government, they will be cut off from Middle Eastern energy resources, and that is not good for people in Europe.
Condemnations are pouring in from across the Muslim world following the burning of a copy of the Holy Quran by the right-wing Swedish-Danish politician in Stockholm. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said the move is a clear example of spreading hatred and violence against Muslims. Nasser Kanani slammed Swedish authorities for allowing the desecration of Islam's holy book. He said such sacrilegious acts cannot be justified under the false pretext of advocating freedom of speech. Turkey also slammed the vile attack on Islam's holy book in the strongest possible terms, saying a planned visit by the Swedish defense minister to the country has been canceled.
We have been following the process regarding this visit. As you are aware, we observed that there had been no reaction from the Swedish administration regarding those disgusting and mean actions against Turkey and our president. At this point, the visit of Swedish Defense Minister Pål Jonson to Turkey on January 27 has become meaningless and has no importance. That's why we canceled the visit.
Meanwhile, Pakistan said the provocative Islamophobic act has hurt the feelings of Muslims around the world. Kuwait also dismissed the blasphemous move as a serious provocation, urging the international community to work towards stopping such moves. And Saudi Arabia called for dialogue, tolerance and coexistence while rejecting hatred and extremism. The United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Jordan and Egypt also condemned the move. The Organization of Islamic Cooperation slammed it as a provocative act insulting Islamic values. Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah and Palestinian resistance movement Hamas condemned the move as well. Our correspondent Rashan Saglam says Turkey has been one of the countries that have categorically condemned the burning of a copy of the Holy Quran by a right-wing Swedish-Danish politician outside the Turkish embassy in Stockholm.
Turkey considers the act of burning Holy Quran as a vile act. And it says that going on with the demonstration, despite all warnings, was a completely unacceptable. The presidential spokesperson, Ibrahim Kalin, also tweeted about the issue, and he said that this is a hate crime, what happened in front of the Turkish embassy. He also said that despite all warnings, Sweden chose to give or allow this demonstration to happen, and he said this is encouraging hate crime, and this is encouraging Islamophobia. Turkey considers actually allowing this protest to happen, knowing that the Holy Quran will be burned. We know that the protesters, or the main character that initiated this hate crime, had tweeted several times that he is going to go with this act and burn the Holy Quran. So the Swedish government should have been aware that this is going to happen. Nevertheless, they still allowed the protest to take place.
Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, tens of thousands of Israelis have once again hit to the streets to vent their anger at the policies of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's far-right cabinet. Israelis have been protesting against Netanyahu for the third straight week. Protesters are expressing their disapproval of what they call a fascist cabinet and its proposed reforms that are meant to increase political power. Last week, an estimated 80,000 people descended on Tel Aviv to deplore the cabinet. Netanyahu returned to power at the head of a coalition with extreme right and ultra-Orthodox parties. The cabinet is planning to hand over more powers to lawmakers in appointing judges and overriding the rulings of the regime's apex court. The coalition also intends to intensify the expansionist policy with more settlement units in the occupied West Bank. To discuss that more, we're joined by Wafa Al-Udaini, a Palestinian activist and journalist who's joining us from Gaza City. Also, we have with us Julia Qasim, journalist and political analyst, joining us from Beirut. Let's begin with our guest from Gaza City. This is the third straight week that people are protesting in Tel Aviv. Does this mean that this new administration and this new cabinet is even too extreme for the Israelis themselves?
Okay, well, actually, it is really very, very wrong to think that those Israelis who took the street and the protest against the new Israeli government, that they protest in solidarity with the Palestinian people. Indeed, they say that they protest against this government because they fear for their democracy. Okay, but indeed, this government is really anti. I mean, not only this government, all of the government, all of the previous Israeli government, they are all anti-democratic. And then they indeed, when they protest against this government, they want to show the world that they care about the democracy. And indeed, this government, the new Israeli racist government, actually, they feel ashamed of it, and it indeed embarrassed them in the international community, because, as you know, that two ministers in this government actually from a terror groups and from Kahana organization. And the Kahana organization, indeed, it is banned internationally, and they considered it as a terrorist group, and it is banned. So this government violated the international law, and indeed, this government, you know, embarrassed the Israelis, and they feel that if the international community, which is considered like the lifeline for Israel, they are the ones who, aid the Israelis with advanced weapon, and they support it, they aid it, they strengthen it against the Palestinian people. So having two ministers in this government from a terror organization, actually this means that this government or even their state, they do not deserve to have a state, or they do not deserve to have a government. So they fear for their image internationally. That's why they are protesting and took the streets in Israel.
Well, actually, Ms. Al-Odaini, you pointed out to the fact that they're fighting for what they call a democracy, and this is actually something I would like to put the spotlight on and bring in our other guest, Julia Qassam from Beirut, in to discuss that. How can we talk about democracy in an occupied land? Are these occupiers, how can they even discuss about democracy?
Exactly. What these protests are showing is that what these protests show is the dissatisfaction and the anger that liberal Israelis have with the occupation, not living up to the ideals and the exceptionalist concept of a Western corruption-free democracy. Obviously, Netanyahu is not being indicted for his crimes against the Palestinians, because that's something that every single, official in this occupying government since 1948 can be indicted for. What he's being indicted for is participating activities that every Western politician engages in, corruption charges that have been built up since 2016, and they're pushing for an investigation in order to kind of uphold to the standard of Western liberal democracy, that is where corruption is reserved for the Oriental despots, not for the West and its allies. So while this does demonstrate an internal contradiction in Israeli political society, it comes at the helm of an even greater contradiction of people protesting for so-called democracy while benefiting from what is essentially occupation by an illegitimate entity.
Thank you very much, Julia Qassam, a journalist and a political analyst from Beirut, and also Wafa Al-Odaini, Palestinian activist and author and journalist from Gaza City. Thank you very much to both of you for sharing your thoughts and views with us on this edition of the News Review. Moving on, Burkina Faso has called for the immediate withdrawal of French troops from the African country. Burkina Faso's military rulers denounced an accord which allowed the presence of French armed forces since 2018, telling France to leave the country within a month. On Friday, people also thronged the streets of the capital to demand the French ambassador leave the country. Burkina Faso's former colonializer maintains some 400 special forces there under the pretext of protecting civilians from extremist militants. People, however, believe France has failed to properly tackle armed groups, and its military presence has even deteriorated the security situation in the country. classified documents were found in the family home of a U.S. president as part of a probe into Joe Biden's mishandling of sensitive government documents. Biden's lawyer says the documents were discovered during a search of his Delaware home this week. Biden voluntarily authorized the search. It came after two batches of classified files were found in the garage of a house and in Washington in an office affiliated with him. They go back to when he was vice president, earlier when he was a senator. The president says that he has done nothing wrong and did not know about the files, but he is facing pressure and calls for a congressional investigation as he prepares for a possible rerun for presidency. In the U.S., the gloomy economic climate is taking a heavy toll on the media industry, with a series of companies announcing layoffs. Vox Media is the latest outlet to declare such cuts, saying it will shed 7% of its workforce. Now, that is more than 130 people. The company cited the, quote, challenging economic environment. The employees' union said it was furious over the announcement. The news follows layoffs at CNN, NBC, MSNBC, and BuzzFeed, as well as other news outlets. The Washington Post also is expected to announce a staff reduction soon. Media and technology sectors in the U.S. have been battered in recent months by falling advertising revenues amid fears of an oncoming recession. Over the past few days, Microsoft, Google, and Amazon have announced up to 40,000 job cuts. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Men and women as human beings are completely equal in Islam. This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, meeting with hundreds of prominent Iranian women in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyah on January 4, 2023. Men have priority over women in capitalism. Therefore, you can see that women are abused in capitalism. They took away women's dignity. And the worst part is what I just mentioned. They have taken this to the point where a woman herself, a young woman or a young girl, sees it in her interest to appear in a sexually attractive manner in order to make herself appealing to men. Which men? The men who are walking in the streets. By drawing women to this decision, they inflicted the greatest blow to them. And now there are many other problems, many of which you probably already know or have read about. So what was the consequences of this particular view? When a man is regarded to be the superior gender in the Western civilization and the civilization is patriarchal, what happens is that women set men as the role models and the man becomes a role model for a woman. Women try to do the same jobs as men. This is the outcome.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
There is an ayah in the Holy Quran that I think one of the women here referred to too. She didn't recite the verse, but I believe this is what she was referring to. The Holy Quran states, Allah cites an example of the faithless, the wife of Noah and the wife of Lut. The Holy Quran, chapter 66, ayah 10. The example referred to for the faithless are two women. Two women who were unbelievers are the examples of women who were the unbelievers. The wife of Noah and the wife of Lut betrayed their husbands. Then they betrayed them, so they did not avail them in any way against Allah. Again mentioned in the Holy Quran, chapter 66, ayah 10. Even though their husbands were prophets, they were of no use to them anymore. They had no benefit for them. This is about the unbelievers. And then there is the verse, and Allah cites an example of the faithful, the wife of Pharaoh. The Holy Quran, chapter 66, ayah 11. Two women are mentioned as role models for all unbelievers, and two women are given as role models for all the believers, both men and women. This means that if all the men in the world wish to be believers, their role models are two women. One is Pharaoh's wife, and the other is Lady Mary.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov has held a press briefing to give an update on the ongoing war in Ukraine. In his press briefing, which was held in Moscow on Wednesday, Lavrov accused Ukraine's foreign policy of being under the dictation of Western nations. The Russian top diplomat further noted that Western nations have yet to make, quote, serious proposals to Russia on how the conflict should be resolved. Lavrov added that Russia was willing to support a draft truce proposed by Ukraine in late March, but the proposal was destroyed by Ukraine's Western supporters. He also said, in reality, the West decides for Ukraine what its foreign policy should be. Western officials have repeatedly claimed that arming Ukraine would help it achieve a better negotiation position and that no talks with Russia should take place before this happens. Lavrov further said Moscow would react to any serious proposal for overcoming the crisis that come from the US and its allies, but none has been sent so far. He also added that the West is using Ukraine to destroy the security system that existed in Euro-Atlantic for many years. Lavrov's comments come amid deepening crisis in Ukraine. On Wednesday, a helicopter crash killed Ukraine's interior minister, his deputy, and the state secretary of the ministry. The deaths have been described as a huge blow for Ukraine. The United States and its Western allies are also ramping up their support for Ukraine. Reports say Mark Milley, chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, met for a couple of hours with Ukraine's chief military officer, General Valery Zaluzhny, in Poland. This is the first face-to-face talks between them since the war began in February 2022. The meetings are expected to focus on Ukraine's ongoing and future military needs. The United Kingdom has also pledged a squadron of its Challenger tanks, but it has too few to form the basis of a Ukrainian force. The moves by the United States and the UK come amid an apparent rift in the anti-Russia coalition.
Well, last year it was $2.3 billion, and from financial year 2023, we'll put in another $2.3 billion. Some of that is non-military aid, some of that is the likes of humanitarian support such as generators, some of that is obviously military hardware, some of it is training. We train 10,000 we trained Ukrainians in the UK, and we'll train another 20,000 in the UK, and some of it is effectively backfilling British stock.
German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has named Boris Pistorius as the country's new defence minister at a time of mounting pressure on Berlin from Western allies to allow Ukraine to use German-made tanks in the war with Russia. However, Germany says when it comes to sending tanks to Ukraine, Berlin is still waiting for the US to take the lead.
And this is the strategy we have, that we are strategically interlocked together with our friends and partners, that we are working together with them, that we are discussing with them, and that we are never doing something just by ourselves, but together with others, especially the United States, which are very important in this common task to defend the Ukrainian independence and sovereignty.
Germany is under pressure to participate in a broader alliance of countries that will supply Ukraine's army with modern Leopard 2 battle tanks. The previous German defense minister, Christine Lambrecht, was a loyal defender of Chancellor Scholz's cautious tank stance. Analysts said the delay so far has to do with disagreements amongst Western countries about the lethality of the weapons Ukraine needed. Russia has denounced the Western weapons supplies. Officials say Ukraine's allies were using the country as a tool to achieve their anti-Russian goals. Kremlin says the tanks that the UK pledged will burn just like the rest.
The European Parliament has called for Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps to be put on the European Union's terror list. The legislator insists that sanctions targeting Tehran had to be expanded following the recent riots in the country. The bill is non-binding and musters a large majority to call on the EU's 27 member states for punitive actions to counter what it calls a swift backsliding of human rights in Iran. EU lawmakers cited the IRGC's handling of the recent riots in Iran and its alleged role in supplying drones to Russia for their decision. It would hit any economic and financial activity involving businesses and commercial activities related to, owned wholly or in part by, or fronting for the IRGC or IRGC-affiliated individuals, regardless of their country of operation. Iran has warned against plans by the European Parliament against the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says the European Parliament has shot Europe in the foot by voting to call on the European Union and its member states to place Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps on the bloc's terror list. Amir Abdollahian made the comments in a phone call with the EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell. The top Iranian diplomat strongly criticized the European Parliament's emotional, injudicious, incorrect, and unprofessional behavior, which is in conflict with political rationality and civility. Amir Abdollahian said it is necessary to respect mutual security in the world of diplomacy and to increase mutual trust instead of following the language of threats and unfriendly actions. Iran has vowed to retaliate against any such move. Iranian lawmakers say that they will definitely show a serious reaction to the EU Parliament's undiplomatic move. The Iranian Parliament will also discuss this decision with high-ranking officials from the Foreign Ministry and other relevant bodies. The General Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces told Europe to be aware of the consequences of its action. The IRGC has been the most important and effective force in the fight against terrorism hatched by the U.S., Israel, and certain Western regimes. IRGC has been involved in the fight against terror more than any other military force. It is also threatened by the sponsors of terrorism, above all, the occupying Israeli regime and the U.S. Iran has warned European governments would not be able to cope with the unbearable consequences of such a designation. It is believed that the EU and European governments need to maintain their independence from the U.S. and avoid taking any action against the IRGC, as such a hostile move could ruin any chance of negotiations with Iran.
Today, the United States is continuing to build its maximum pressure campaign against the Iranian regime. I am announcing our intent to designate the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, including its Quds Force, as a foreign terrorist organization, in accordance with Section 219 of the Immigration and Nationality Act. This designation will take effect 1 week from today.
Back in 2019, the former U.S. President Donald Trump designated the IRGC as a foreign terrorist organization. That was the first time the U.S. labeled another nation's military as a terrorist organization, and Iran retaliated by declaring U.S. forces in West Asia as a terrorist organization. CENTCOM is the Pentagon wing that oversees Washington's security interests across the West Asia region, most notably Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, and Syria.
When the U.S. NATO bombed Afghanistan for 20 years and killed several hundred thousand and displaced millions, they were terrorizing the people. A UN survey showed that US NATO bombardments of civilians in Afghanistan, 45% of the people killed were children. When the US killed over a million civilians in Iraq, was that terrorism? When Israel terrorizes the Palestinian people every day, is that terrorism? When France and the UK and others armed the Saudi UAE to commit genocide in Yemen, where the UN said that over 400,000 are dead and 16 million are starving because of a genocide being carried out with the support of the US, the UK, France and several European states, is that terrorism? When he's going to wake up and start living in the real world?
A prominent pro-reform law professor in Saudi Arabia is facing the death penalty for alleged crimes including having a Twitter account and using WhatsApp to share news considered hostile to the kingdom. The ruling against Awad al-Gharni, a pro-reform law professor in Saudi Arabia, was made public in a report published by The Guardian newspaper. Gharni's son, Nasser, who fled the kingdom last year and is living in the UK, shared the details of the charges brought against his father with the British Daily. Gharni, who was arrested in September 2017, was labeled in Saudi-controlled media as a dangerous preacher, but dissidents said the 65-year-old was an important and well-regarded intellectual with a strong social media following, including 2 million Twitter followers. Public prosecutors have called for the death penalty in the case, but the court has yet to make a formal judgment. The charges against Gharni, for which he is facing the death penalty, included the law professor's admission that he used a social media account under his own name and used it at every opportunity to express his opinions. The court documents also claim that Gharni admitted participating in a WhatsApp chat and was accused of participating in videos in which he praised Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood. Gharni's use of Telegram and creation of a Telegram account was also included in the allegations. Last year, Salma Al-Shahab, a Leeds PhD student and mother of two, received a 34-year sentence for having a Twitter account and for following and retweeting dissidents and activists. Another woman, Noura Al-Qahtani, was sentenced to 45 years in prison for using Twitter. The Saudi regime is also accused of ordering the 2018 brutal murder of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, a U.S.-Saudi citizen who used to be a vocal critic of the Saudi royalty. Khashoggi was dismembered during a visit to the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. The ruling against the Saudi professor comes as human rights advocates and Saudi activists have warned that authorities in Riyadh are engaged in a severe crackdown on individuals who are perceived to be critics of the Saudi regime, as the use of social media and other communications have been criminalized inside the kingdom since the beginning of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's reign in 2017. The Saudi government and state-controlled investors have recently increased their financial stake in U.S. social media platforms, including Twitter and Facebook, and entertainment companies such as Disney. Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal, a Saudi investor, is the second largest investor in Twitter after Elon Musk's takeover of the social media platform. The investor was himself detained for 83 days during a so-called anti-corruption purge in 2017. Prince Al-Waleed has acknowledged that he was released after he had reached, quote, an understanding with the kingdom that was confidential and secret between me and the government. Saudi Arabia's Sovereign Wealth Fund, the public investment fund, has separately increased its stake in Facebook and Meta, the company that owns Facebook and WhatsApp. Jeet Basuni, the head of Middle East and North African advocacy at Reprieve, the human rights group, said Al-Gharni's case fits into a trend the group has observed of scholars and academics facing the death penalty for tweeting and expressing their views. Asked about the kingdom's investment in Facebook and Twitter, Basuni said, if it wasn't so sinister, it would be farcical. It's consistent with how they are operating under this crown prince. Since bin Salman became Saudi Arabia's de facto leader in 2017, the kingdom has arrested hundreds of activists, bloggers, intellectuals, and others for their political activism, showing almost zero tolerance for dissent, even in the face of international condemnation of the crackdown. Muslim scholars have been executed and women's rights campaigners have been put behind bars and tortured as freedom of expression, association, and belief continue to be denied by the kingdom's authorities. Over the past years, Riyadh has also redefined its anti-terrorism laws to target activism.
Israel is experiencing unprecedented mass protests. Tens of thousands of Israelis have hit the streets in several cities, including Tel Aviv, Al-Quds, and Haifa, for the second consecutive week to protest against plans by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to implement changes to Israel's legal system and weaken the Supreme Court. The demonstration presents an early challenge to Netanyahu and his far-right minister Etmar Ben-Gvir, was ordered police to take tough action if protesters block roads or display Palestinian flags. In defiance of Ben-Gvir's call, some footage showed Palestinian flags on display. The crowd in Tel Aviv swelled to more than 80,000 people despite rainy weather there. Demonstrators, many covered by umbrellas, held signs and chanted slogans like criminal government or the end of democracy. But what were they protesting that gave way to such a large crowd to come out?
We would like to say that the current coalition in Israel would like to change the regime to make us like a dark regime in the world, and we will not accept it and will fight for this democracy.
The focus of the protests was how the new coalition cabinet, headed by Netanyahu, wants to decrease the power of the Supreme Court in its own favor. This as Netanyahu is trying to escape charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. The situation has already angered Israeli officials, including the president. Herzog also warned that Israel faced, quote, a historic constitutional crisis over the contested judicial reform plan. But despite all that criticism, Netanyahu has pledged to complete legislating the reforms in a way that will correct what needs correcting totally protect individual rights, as he claims, and restore the public's faith in the justice system that so much requires such reform. The legal changes could help Netanyahu evade eviction of corruption or even make his trial disappear entirely. Office for more than just 2 weeks, Benjamin Netanyahu's right-wing cabinet has launched proposals to weaken the Supreme Court by giving parliament the power to overturn court decisions with a simple majority vote. It also wants to give parliament control over the appointment of judges and reduce the independence of legal advisors. Israeli opposition leaders, former attorneys general, and the president of Israel's Supreme Court have all spoken out against the plan. They said a move would cripple judicial independence, foster corruption, set back minority rights, and deprive Israel's courts of credibility that helps fend off war crimes abroad. Critics said the changes could help Netanyahu evade conviction in his corruption trial or make the trial disappear altogether. But are these protests against Netanyahu himself? Netanyahu's premiership in the past has been fraught not only with trying to escape corruption charges, but also violations like Palestinian rights, settlement construction, and other hot-button issues that exist between Palestinians and Israel. Inside Israel, the opposition against the current right-wing cabinet and Netanyahu is so high and elevated that a new movement has been created to promote and encourage Israelis to leave Israel, with a group planning to move 10,000 Israeli Jews in the first stage of its project. Meanwhile, grassroots Palestinians with no affiliation to any of the resistance groups are rising against the regime. Den of Lions is one, an independent armed Palestinian group operating in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. In the meantime, the current right-wing cabinet and its far-right minister Ben-Gvir are advocating more violence against Palestinians, which would lead to more deaths, including violations like settlement buildings, changing the demographics of Al-Aqsa and Al-Quds, and other core issues. The cost of living is one other major issue protesters are angry with. After all, Israel is expensive and has one of the highest costs of living in the world. With all the crises the regime is grappling with, what seems to be on the corner for officials in Tel Aviv is what a protester said during a Saturday demonstration. "I came here to demonstrate against the anti-democratic steps of the new cabinet. This can be the start of the end of the Jewish state as we know it. Is this cabinet igniting the start of the end of Israel?" This exactly signifies what former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak expressed concern about, the survival of Israel. Barak said the entity will cease to exist before the 80th anniversary of its 1948 establishment. He said throughout the Jewish history, the Jews did not rule for more than 80 years, except in the two kingdoms of David and the Hasmonean dynasty. And in both periods, their disintegration began in the 8th decade.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam, I
Allah, my Lord.
Allah, my Lord.
His word, Quran.
His word, Quran.
Muhammad, Prophet.
Muhammad, Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio. Beautiful youth station.
Yeah.
Here at your service. I am Mita.
And I'm Asma at your service. Welcome home. We're home again.
Yeah. I want to ask you something, frankly.
So directly.
So
you go
directly,
into the
yeah,
topic.
Exactly.
That means today we have a tough topic.
Do you have any problem with your parents? I don't know. Sometimes you are sure that they are wrong.
Yeah, and who doesn't have problem with their parents?
Thank you.
Show me someone who doesn't have problem. I mean, see, not problem as in a war.
I know.
No.
But sometimes it becomes a war.
Sometimes it's just a little misunderstanding. Sometimes it's the fact that they are not...
Only a little misunderstanding.
Only a very little.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's the fact that they are not at your age, so they do not understand what you're talking about. The thing that matters to you does not matter to them at all. Sometimes it's about some details that are very important to us. But
and
it's not that important for them.
Let me mention something. This balance of power, you know, when you're a kid, your parents want to take control over you, you know, because they know that you may do something wrong.
Yeah.
But after a long time, you will gain this
independence.
And this independency,
you become a free state
for them. You know, they don't want to lose their control over you.
See, I won't call it a control because one day you're going to become a mother and then you understand.
Maybe.
Then I am not a mother myself, but I can understand that feeling.
Me too. I can imagine.
I have a younger brother and then I feel like his mother. Because this supportiveness that you have toward them, this feeling that you want them to be always happy and always safe, makes you do things that it might look like controlling them, but it's not actually controlling them.
I know.
It's more of supporting them or just leaving them in a box safe. And you are making sure that no danger is going to get into that box.
Yeah, you were telling me some sort of cliches or something, which,
I agree.
I do agree that, they want to, protect us. They're dangerous in society. And
don't you believe that they want to protect you?
Okay. No, I believe.
So.
I know that.
So,
know?
First point is settled right in here.
But sometimes, there are some situations that you are sure that your parents are wrong about something.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's not a misunderstanding. It's about certainty.
So how come you make sure that your parents are wrong? Do you have any tangible experience to share with us?
For example, sometimes you know you love something, you have passion for something, which is logical.
For example, I
love literature. I know that I may be successful in that area, but my parents, because for example, we are a third world country, and in these sort of countries, it's like you have to be a doctor, you have to be an engineer to be successful or something.
In order to have a prosperous life in future.
Yeah, exactly. They force you to go through this road of, studying medicine, studying engineering or something, and you know that if you,
go the other way, you might be more successful. Yeah,
so,
now I get what you say. Yeah, that's true.
This is the time that you have to and oppose them, and tell them, you are wrong. You're misunderstanding my personality.
Let me tell you my reaction in those situations, and then you tell me.
Okay.
In those situations, when I am so sure they're wrong, I turn into a very nagging girl.
Thank you.
And then I want to stop nagging unless I get what I want.
Beautiful way. So wisely.
Yes. See, I talk to them logically. If they don't understand, I would insist more. And if they don't understand, then I would illogically go for the thing that I want.
you know, it is not
appropriate. Now I'm teaching you bad things.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm being the devil right in here.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. In these kind of situations, I just talk to them logically and tell them with, I don't know, with this beautiful soft voice, okay, I know your parents, I know you have your own reasons to tell me, for example, go this road, but I have to tell you that. And then it will end with no special conclusion.
So before we turn the table into fire, let's go for a short break and come back. This is Youth Station. I am Asma, and here I have Bita with me. We're talking about parents and the
fight.
Never-ending yeah. fight and quarrel and dispute and
misunderstanding and misconceptions
of parents and children. See, we talked about the very fact that they're supportive. We know that they love us. We know that whatever they say is going to be for our benefit, of course. But sometimes it happens that they insist on something wrong. Like, for example, they pick my major that is going to be the thing that I'm going to end up my life with. So in these occasions, there might be different reactions. Some of us are not so cool and so easy, and we go for fights and we do things that are unwanted, but they happen because they did not pay any heed to our logical explanations. So what happens is that a war happens.
But I'm never the winner. Yeah, it's really dark.
Never, really, never?
Never, never, ever. And, you know, this is somehow...
So you should change your strategy, I suppose.
I cannot. Yeah.
Once it's out, it's out.
See,
I'm recommending you to change your strategies. Yeah. Maybe that might change a little bit of the story.
Maybe I will. One of the things that I want to tell you as an example here, which in compared to these kind of situation that I told you, sometimes there are some families, you know, for example, they tell their girls and so on, okay, you are too young. For example, they're 9 years old, but they tell them, okay, you're too young to make hijab or something. But, you know, that child, I don't know, according to the education at school, whatever, know that she has to make a job at that age. And this kind of conflict...
You mean she has to go for a job?
Yeah. No, I'm not telling you she has to. She wants to.
Oh, she likes to go.
Yeah, she likes to go for
that. So she is more of a trader from the age of 9. Yes, I have seen of those children.
And this is beautiful somehow for me to see that. But what is the reaction, the proper reaction that we have to have? I don't know.
See, there are two sides in this story. One is the side of parents and the other is the side of children. The side of parents, well, we know that they love us. We know that they want the best for us. Mm-hmm. And we know that as a parent, it is very difficult for you to accept that, okay, I'm going to let my child do whatever trait they have in their mind at the age of 10 or 12 or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
It is very difficult. So we understand that. But we put that aside and we're talking of the side of the youth and the children, who is us, of course.
Yeah.
So the first thing first is that we should talk. I usually say that the majority of misunderstanding that happens between parents and children and even husbands and wives and whatever disagreement that happens in this world is because of not having the true understanding of each other's perspective.
Yeah.
Because we too can sit in a special place and look at the same thing, but the thing that we see is different.
And let me tell you the conclusion of this action that you're telling me, which is really appropriate. We have to talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we have to understand and know this fact that we are human beings too. Sometimes we make some, I don't know, idols or something like that out of our parents. And we think like, okay, they don't make mistakes. They don't, I don't know, commit sins. They don't do these. They don't do that. But it's not like that. They're human beings.
Yeah, they are human beings and they have their own flaws as well.
Yeah. You know, I think sometimes we make them that much holy or something like that or like Santas that we cannot accept that they can do something wrong too.
Well, let me just add something for the record. Well, in our religion, we have been always recommended to respect our parents.
Yeah.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
The one who brought me into this world was my mother and my father, and they both care for me. They love me. They have done so much for me. And if there is standing in my way for the things that I want, perhaps, and the great chance is that they are doing that out of love and they want the best for me. For example, if they ask you to go for medicine, it's because they are aware of the situation in their own country. They know that if you study that, then you're going to have a more prosperous life. If you want to be a poet, if you want to be a writer, then you're not going to have a lot of money for your future.
To some extent, I do agree with you. But why don't they ask me, for example, what is your goal of life? Maybe this prosperity, maybe this money is not whatever I want.
Yeah, I know what you mean. But then perhaps you're not in the right age to decide. Believe me, sometimes when you're in a specific age, you feel that life is just about the things, the ideal things that you have in your mind. And then as you grow older, then you come to face this life that is real. And the real life is cruel.
You're breaking my heart.
No. Honey, I'm so sorry for that. I'm just giving you the reality in a gist.
Yeah, I know.
See, the true life is very much ruthless, and you have to cope up with it. And in order to cope up with it, you have to have a special facilities. You have to develop some special talents in yourself. So whatever they say, I don't mean to say that whatever they do is right, because I am of those people who believe that everyone has got a chance to live the life that they want to, whatever it is. Even if I want to end up in the streets, even if I want to end up as a poor person,
I want to see your children in the future.
This is your choice. Mm-hmm. You are going to be born once and you're going to live your life once. So it is the decision of yours to make. There are children who are so reckless, and they go for some dangerous path that as a parent, you cannot tolerate seeing that, much less thinking about that. So what happens is that they start forcing them. Of course, I do believe that forcing anyone in this world is not going to do any good, because in the end, one day, that person is going to explode.
Yeah.
And once they explode, once they boost that much of courage, then you cannot tame them. The situation is going to go out of control.
We have to have a kind of friendly relationship. By friendly relationship, I don't mean that, for example, this relationship will make that children rebellious or something that I know you have on your mind, that you're going to tell me that, okay, if you are friends with your parents, you're not going to listen to them because you're friends, you know. There should be a kind of trust.
Yeah, a trust and understanding, and also give them the chance to leave.
And also the acceptance of making mistakes. You know, sometimes you make mistakes.
Yeah, that's
true. It's a mistake, but you cannot tell them because there is not that atmosphere of acceptance of making mistakes.
Yeah.
You know, they have to accept that you are young. You don't, I don't know, you lack knowledge, you lack experience, you lack everything. And in this road, you may do something wrong.
Exactly. Yeah, I do believe in that. As a human being, we have been brought into this world. And without making mistakes, sometimes we cannot learn things.
Yeah.
Sometimes I have to go to the wrong path. I'm so sorry to say that, but sometimes it's the reality,
We are human.
We go for the wrong thing in order to get something very much worthy and learn a lesson that is going to do too much of goodness to me. It's not always about the experience of other people's. They say, actually, there is a beautiful thing that I have read it, and it always is there in my mind. They say that to me, hearing that the sands of the shore are soft is not enough. I want to experience it myself. Yeah. I am not actually saying that it's okay to do all the things that comes to your mind. No, sometimes you know the result is going to end up bad. For those things, you have to stop take a breath and then think, and then let your parent tell you whatever logic and experience they have. Because, you know, as I told you, we have to respect them as well. No matter what, no matter how wrong they are, we have to respect them, because at the end of the day, these are our parents and we share a strong bond with them. So that's all.
You know, my own strategy for this kind of situation is that I always remember all the sacrifices they made in their lives because of
that's
me.
That's very true.
You know?
Tell them your ideas, respect them, and do things in a way that both sides are satisfied.
Yeah, exactly. Conversation is
always the answer. Try to understand each other. And we have to say goodbye to everyone who's listening to us.
It's so dark. The dark part of the episode is...